Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I believe this is night nine, and there are going to be quite a few streams tonight. In 2 hours from now, I will have Academic Agent on, and then Beginner Homesteader, then Praise of Folly, and then Ramsey Paul. But first, I have Petter Hampel on, and he is a sociologist. I'll allow him to introduce himself.
Hello. Good evening.
Welcome to Millennial.
So, introducing myself, I'm a sociologist. I got my PhD in Prague University. I wrote several books. One of them is in English. It was published by Arctos. And my key areas of interest are elites, social stratification, and erotic capital, which is a bit different from that. But I wrote a book about that.
Right.
And concerning my background, I think it was 5 years ago. You know, I live in the Czech Republic, which may be important for understanding. And some 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the atmosphere here was very free, very nice. As an illustration, some 10 years ago, there was a discussion about harassment or sexual harassment, and our minister of justice. Which was a very nice lady, said in television, "I have been harassed for all of my life, and I hope it will continue for many years." you can't imagine something like that in Britain or in the US.
Absolutely not, no. No.
Here it was okay.
Right,
right. But as we are more close and close to Western Europe, and more people are coming with practice in Western Europe and foundations from US and Western Europe are more and more active here, the atmosphere is not now so free as it used to be.
One of the things that's often said about these countries, that in Eastern European countries and the ex-Soviet states, they have already seen communism, they've already experienced it, and therefore they can see it coming in the shape of political correctness. Would you say that?
Definitely.
So, 'cause I can imagine, again, another thing that's said about communism is that it has no sense of humor, and any totalitarian power cannot laugh at itself, cannot see any... there's a lack of humanity about it. But we're now in that situation here in the West, in the Anglosphere, where the regime cannot brook any... It cannot stand jokes about LGBT, feminism, climate change, COVID... There can be no humor at all, really, increasingly. So do you recognize that as something that it has the same tone as communism did?
Yes and no, because definitely we see coming totalitarianism here. There are many topics we could discuss 5 years ago, 10 years ago, which we can't discuss now. As a small example, some 6-7 years ago, I founded here White Straight Man Pride Society. And it was just a joke. We were drinking beer, making jokes of feminists, and it was nice 5 years ago.
Right, right.
Last year, we tried to organize a regular meeting, and somebody from team of Prague City Mayor approached the restaurant and asked them to cancel reservation. You know, 5 years ago, it was impossible. So the times are changing. We are less and less free, definitely. And
sorry, go on.
And it is also on universities, because very young, very ambitious people with experience from the US or Western Europe are coming. Often there are really neo-Marxists, very violent neo-Marxists. And so I don't work for Prague University anymore. I am a freelance sociologist. I am doing some small researches, making public lectures in pubs, restaurants, and writing books.
Now, I was going to say, because the universities in Britain and America are now battlegrounds where Antifa intimidate people, silence people, disrupt events, so that it's impossible. I mean, it's impossible for there to be a far right or nationalistic gathering or event, because Antifa will simply stop it from happening.
Yeah.
But physically, but first they'll try to get it cancelled, and they'll try to intimidate or harass those in a position to cancel it until they cancel it. But if they don't, then they'll attack the event, or they'll attack the speakers, demonize them, or physically attack them. And so it's unbelievable now. I mean, I don't know what to say, but I can understand why you left the university, because clearly it's becoming, it seems to be a place where there isn't supposed to be thinking anymore.
In fact, Prague University still isn't Berkeley. But the atmosphere is worse and worse, and there is a big generational gap. People after 50, I would say, they're okay. They're okay. But these very young, very ambitious scientists, that's bad with them.
Is that something that is acknowledged, that older people aren't on, they don't have fashionable ideas, that they aren't on message, that they aren't politically correct? Or is that just something that you've noticed?
No, I think it is generally talked that, or it is generally discussed, that there is big difference between people, I think, 50 or older than 50, and young people. In Czech discussion, it is often explained by Euro-Marxists or Euro-communists, or how to call them, that these older people are bad because they are damaged by communism. But it is not true. They just love free discussion.
See, that's ironic, because I would say that young people today are damaged by global homo, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think we've entered an age where people, as I said, cannot think. They're now trained in how not to think. They're supposed to have this opinion on this issue, and that's that.
Yeah.
So it's astonishing that they could think anyone else is damaged by some other totalitarianism. Sorry, go on.
You know, I experienced only the last years of the Soviet-style system. But definitely, we had more freedom in the last years of Soviet communism than now.
Right. I've heard that said elsewhere, the pressure to be politically correct today is actually greater than it was in the 80s, in the last decade of the Soviet era. It's incredible Because I'm old enough and to remember the 90s and the 2000s. And this has come up quite a few times on this show recently. That there was clearly a different tone to everyday life.
Definitely.
Definitely in the 90s. I would say in the 2000s, up until about 10 years ago. And then it started to change. And then certainly in the last 2 years with the COVID era, it has changed again. I would say that we are now in a totalitarian way of living. Just the fact that there has been no debate on television about COVID indicates that there is only one opinion allowed about this. And indeed, people who disagree with that will be demonized. In fact, I just heard today about a nurse who has been sacked, who has been fired for saying on an online radio show that COVID is a scam. I think that's in Scotland. I should clarify, just for the sake of it, what is your stance on COVID and COVID-19 and all of this?
Sorry, I am vaccinated and I support vaccination. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I just wondered. I don't judge anyone for being vaccinated. But I do think that there is, I'm very skeptical about why they want everyone to get vaccinated for a disease that has a 0.4% mortality rate. That's the fundamental thing that concerns me. Why, and all the lockdowns and all this, it's done huge damage to the economy. It's altered everyday life, all because of a disease that hardly kills anyone. That's what makes me suspicious. But anyway, we don't need to go into that because we have a topic that we're going to focus on, which is sociopathy. And so people use, this is one of those terms like psychopath, sociopath, that people use a lot. It can be used rather loosely. And I know that officially, it's an obsolete word, and you're supposed to say antisocial personality disorder. But still, it's a word that persists, as does psychopath. So, would you like to explain what you mean by a sociopath first?
Okay, I think it is people. Sociopaths are people with special brain. Because they lack part of empathy. For normal people have some level of empathy, women more than men in average. And some people have no empathy, which makes their life quite difficult because they don't understand people around. They are confused, etc. Very often these people are very good at mathematics, physics, they are scientists. But sociopaths are something special. They can understand the feeling of people around them, but they still feel no empathy, which enables them to be very effective.
Yeah, that's even worse, really, isn't it?
Yeah. They are very effective in keeping power, influencing people, but no mercy. And their brain are such. Basically, you can't do too much with them.
And do you think that they are, this is a debate, but what is your opinion on this? Are they made by their genetics or are they made into this by their upbringing? What do you think?
I think it is the same as with other features, both. Basically, it is inborn. But, of course, if people are encouraged to to perform such behavior. They are better and better in that, if we can use the word better. If they were discouraged, some of them would be able to behave quite normal, I think.
All right, okay. I just want to get this clarified. A psychopath doesn't understand other people's emotions. Is that what you said?
Oh, no. It's even worse. He understands, but he doesn't respect.
Right. And then, so what is the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath?
In my opinion, no.
Right. Okay. And is that one distinction that I saw was that a psychopath is born, whereas a sociopath is made by their experiences, their childhood. And then another one was that, oh gosh, it was quite subtle, like psychopaths, I think it was that they don't understand other people's emotions, but sociopaths do, and they just don't feel any concern for them. This is why these terms are now, they're quite murky, they're quite difficult to use. But anyway, so we were going to talk about sociopathy in the corporate sector, because I discovered you via an article that you, or an essay that you published on Countercurrents. I think I linked it below, or maybe I didn't. That's unfortunate. Hold on a second. I'll make sure to link that. Hold on. I want to have this on. Because there is a long time association, especially because of things like American Psycho. Between the corporate sector and psychopathy, sociopathy. There's this link, this sort of cliche of the sociopathic yuppie. Would you like to talk about that briefly?
I think first we need to understand that it is not just a matter of corporations or private sector corporation, because there is one social class or one social group covering corporations, leaders of political parties, people in big media, some leaders in universities. These big guys create one environment, and they are very, very similar one to other. In fact, many people travel through. Somebody spends 5 years in a board of a company, then goes to government, then goes to university, then goes to other corporation, or in other cases, wife is working in corporation, husband is working in big university. It's really one group of people.
One sort of class in society.
One class, I used to work class.
Yeah, that's the way I've seen it talked about. The husband will be working, he'll be on a six-figure salary at a charity, while the wife is at top of a corporation or in a local council. She'll be the head of the council. Or they'll be working in the corporate sector, or they'll be working in politics. And again, the example that I always love to use is Nick Clegg, a British politician who started off in the European Union. That was where he started his political career, then went into national politics in Britain, became the deputy prime minister, and is now one of the most senior figures at Facebook. So he's actually gone into the private sector after politics and, you know, into a very senior position. I find that quite interesting and worrying as well, because I'm not even saying that it shouldn't happen, but the links are worrying, because you need the government to be opposed to be holding big business to account, not to be the same people who are in big business. I once saw this described as the managerial class or the nomenklatura class, which is a reference to the Soviet era in Russia. But would you have anything more to say about that before we go on.
Yeah. I call it the new aristocracia, but you can use words like new upper class or something like. I think basic trouble with this new class is that it is huge. It has much more members than any leading class in history, and this creates big difference. Because some 40 years ago, 50 years ago, perhaps 30 years ago, even members of this high class often met normal people on streets, on holidays, etc. And in fact, there were quite small differences in thinking between them and normal people. The basic difference was that normal working class people drove small cars, they drove big cars. Working class people had small houses, they had big houses or several houses. But basically, their lifestyle was quite similar. They could share ideas about marriage, about child education, and about nation. And other things. Now we have completely detached class with no contacts with normal people. Now if you work as a board member or even be minus one or be numbers two in a corporation, you have no reason to meet a normal person during oral life. You eat in a restaurants where all people are from your class. You spend holidays on destinations where all people are from your class. Your children are attending school also for your class. You have no idea about normal people. And your class is so big that you can develop your own taste, your own kitchen, your own way of dressing, your own religion, I don't know what, completely detached.
One thing I've read about this is that it's an international class. I mean, it's not really geographically rooted in particular places. I think that might be at a higher level, but what would you say about that?
Definitely, it is international, which means these people are English-speaking. English is something like their first language, even if not. In fact, it is not typical English. It is business English, which is very simple. But their mother language is now business English. They live in corporate sector, which means they can spend one day in Prague, second day in Paris, third day in New York. For a weekend, they go to Italy. They are not connected to any nation, to any state. In fact, they despise national states. They despise nation. They despise normal people, partly because they don't know them.
Yeah. And there is also the phenomenon, I'm sure you'll have heard of it, of third culture kids. Do you know that term? Well, it's the children of these people.
Yeah.
Because it's the children who, their father will be a diplomat, their mother will work in a corporation, and they travel around the world. So the child will live for two, like, they'll have 2 years of their childhood in this country, then 2 years in that country at the other side of the world, and then 2 years in that, because they'll just move where their parents' jobs demand.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, they'll have to be educated at international schools. And the kids that they'll meet at those schools will have exactly the same lifestyle. It will be the children of politicians, diplomats, corporate leaders, ambassadors, etc. So this leads to a class system, because this is the upper class. And so they don't belong anywhere. I mean, they might have a country that both their parents were from, and that is ostensibly might have been where they were born. But and that's ostensibly their home country, but it's not really, because they've only spent a year of their childhood there, and they've spent the rest in five other countries. And all the other children that they're friends with are exactly the same, and might be of different races, might be of different religions, might have no religion, probably, and certainly don't have a nation. So this is what a third culture kid is, and it's a phenomenon that I can't remember when it was first noted. I think it was in the 80s, which seems a long time ago now, for this stuff to have happened. But such people then grow up to be incapable of bonding with a country, incapable of having any sense of home. So then it perpetuates itself.
Yeah, in fact, for them, patriots are sick people. Something very strange, very old, dinosaurs, or how to call them.
Definitely.
Yeah. Something obsolete. And we have another trouble also with young people or with next generations. And that some people who grew up in a normal country would like to join this class, and they are very enthusiastic to imitate all behavior and all thinking of this international class. They have disputes with their parents. Sometimes they despise their parents like obsoletes. They took part in, I don't know, climate saving demonstrations and all this stuff.
Greta Thunberg. About.
Yeah. They love Greta. They talk about 66 sexes, or I don't know these all stupidities. And they live in houses with normal parents and having disputes all the time.
And resenting that they do belong to a nation.
I think
I think they'd actually wish that they didn't. And, you know, I can remember having feelings like thoughts like this when I was like 16, 17, just actually wanting to be sort of a default, like blank slate, just default human being without any biases, without any prejudices.
Yeah.
Because it was in the air then that, I thought that I'd arrived at this idea myself and I was really clever, but I must have just been working off the ideas of that were in the culture. And I thought that would be better, because then you would not make mistakes. You wouldn't be prejudiced. You wouldn't be swayed by bias or whatever. You'd be a kind of robot, I guess, an impartial human being. But of course, that's completely impossible, because even if you didn't have any nation, you would still have your own genetic, your own...
Yeah. And they try to educate their parents about the new man and new humanity and all these stupidities.
Well, now, yes, exactly. Nowadays there are, and I guess then as well to some extent, 20 years ago, but especially now, there are all these political things that young people can get involved with and then preach to their parents about. And climate change, LGBT and all this, it's in all of the institutions, so it is being taught to all the young. But to get back to the matter of the globalist children, third culture kid children, they inevitably grow up and can't belong to a nation. So they inevitably enter the same, they have the same lifestyle that their parents had. They have the same sort of careers, and they're also primed for it by their education, because they will grow up speaking three different languages perhaps, and they'll grow up hearing about and just in that culture of international travel and not belonging anywhere, and being able to go to a new city and immediately acclimatize to it and learn about the transport system here and so on. I mean, you can understand from their point of view, they are very flexible people. They're very, they're not racist. They're not bigoted. They're very, well, they're very open-minded in a sense. And they're adaptable. They can handle different types of situations. So you can understand why they would think that they are superior to us, for want of a better word.
Yes and no. I think their big asset is adaptability. They can adapt to anything. And even then can change ideas, change their mindset very fast. Now they are fans of Greta. Okay, in 1 week, it may happen that Greta is accused of racism and they will be against Greta. Definitely, they will hate Greta as much as they love you. They are very flexible, which is very good and very important in their environment.
Right, yes. So this brings us back to the issue of sociopathy, I guess.
Yeah. In an environment of normal people, it wouldn't be so nice to be such flexible without limits. On the other hand, they have some weaknesses, definitely. For example, they are definitely not brave. They are not able to accept challenge face to face. They are very good in power games, but not in bravery.
Are you talking about sociopaths in
no,
general?
General members of this okay, of this okay, of this class.
Okay.
Their men are much less masculine than men of lower classes. I think basically it is much more difficult for them to keep idea and to go after something and to persevere
for
lower class people. So there are good in some things and bad in other things. And concerning sociopathy, I think in all ages, it has been that upper you go, more psychopaths and more sociopaths you meet. It's during all history. And in fact, it is sometimes not completely bad, because, for example, military leaders must be a bit sociopath or psychopaths. Without that, they wouldn't be able to win wars. And there are some other positions where we need some people.
Yeah.
The trouble is if entire class is consisted from such people. It's very bad. And I think there are two reasons for that. Why? One, there are thoroughly trained in despising of normal people. All their classmates are from the same class as they are. They have no friends between normal people. A few weeks ago, one such person said to me, "I can't understand why I should have more sympathies for other Czechs than for people in Somalia." Which means no sympathy.
Yeah, this is a huge thing. I remember. See, that's a fashionable leftist idea. That well, why should I care? That would be racist of me, but it would also be irrational of me because, well, the Somalians are human beings too. That there was the famous case of and this isn't funny. This was disgusting. I think it was in Sweden. And let's say that it was an African guy. I think he was, Somalian, and he raped a Swedish woman, and the Swedish state wanted to deport him back to Somalia, And this judge said, well, no, because why does the safety of Somalian women matter less than the safety of Swedish women to us? Why? And also, they will be less, like in Somalia, they'll be less able to deal with him than we are in Sweden. So we should take the burden. But I find that quite incredible. But also it makes sense. You know, from their point of view, that's rational. It's just rational. But yeah, it can only happen if you don't have that feeling of duty, obligation to your own people, or you don't even think you have your own people. It's just, they're just the individuals who happen to be in the same country as you just now.
Yeah, and I believe there is one point more. If you have the same sympathy for everybody, we have real sympathy for nobody.
Yeah. I think that... Can you explain that? Because I can imagine someone saying, well, I care about everybody's welfare.
Okay. For example, there are many things, you know, I'm Czech, I'm European, and I can share many joys, and feelings with other Czechs and other Europeans. But for example, this, if we talk about this, we talk Somalians, I can't really feel empathy for a Somalian man of my age whose daughter committed some bad behavior and he needs to stone her. Because I typically don't stone my daughters.
Yeah.
And I really don't know this feeling. And it is for me very, very difficult to be on one wife with him.
Okay, so that's a different meaning to the word sympathize. Because I can imagine someone saying, well, I care about everybody's welfare. That's why I sympathize with the Somalians. But sympathizing, you and I cannot sympathize with a Somalian who's going to stone his daughter or is going to, you know, beat his daughter in some horrific way. That's so alien to us. And I don't believe, I understand what you mean now. It's a lie. It's an affectation for us to tell ourselves that we, you know, connect with that Somalian. The truth is that we have nothing in common with them at all.
Yeah. And concerning taking care of other people, still, nobody can't take care of all people around the globe. If this judge said, I have the same taking care for Somalian girls like Swedish girls. In fact, what was very likely his situation was that he was very interested or normally interested in fate of girls in his social class, which is international, and no real interest in ordinary Swedish girls and no real interest in ordinary Somalian girls. That's the situation.
Yes, either that or he has just a guilt. He's crippled with, you know, Swedish guilt. But it's going to be one of those two things. Either he's crippled, he is Swedish and he is like a typical Swede, crippled with guilt about nationhood and feeling he's racist and all that, or he's off this international class and he genuinely doesn't feel an obligation to the Swedish people. It's amazing.
And don't forget that many people who are not really members of international class, they would like to be and they would like to feel like members of this class, which means they take attitude of the class and imitate it.
Yeah, adopt it as an affectation. As I was sort of doing at 17. I mean, what can be done about this? Because it's obviously you can understand how it happens. People have always looked to the rich and thought, okay, I'm not rich, but if I act like they do, then that they must have the best ideas. They must have the best lifestyle. So if I act like I have those ideas, if I adopt their ideas, then I am one step closer to being like them. You can understand people thinking like that. And I think they always have. And also in this age, because we're all supposed to be not racist. And, well, how better to prove that you're not racist by belonging nowhere?
Yeah.
I guess that this brings us to the... right up to the present day with the idea of belonging nowhere, the idea of the pod, that kind of thing. What would you say about this?
Just a small comment about racism. I believe that there are basically two ways how you can see the world and how you can see other people. One way is nationalist. One way is racist. Nationalists are not racists, and racists are not nationalists. It's simple, impossible to combine. You need to decide. that's one way. I'm convinced that everybody who strictly refuses nationalism will become racist.
Okay, so can you explain this? Obviously liberals listening in would be very confused. So could you explain?
Okay, because nationalist view is based on culture and language. Nation is community of culture, language, shared history, common solidarity, and all that. Nation is basically not based on genes.
That's one way to look at it. I mean, there is civic nationalism, but I believe the word nation has a Latin root that actually means nature. I can't remember now, but okay, please go on.
While a racist view means everybody of your race is yours, regardless culture, behavior, and I don't know what. Which I think, okay, somebody can see that. If I told you 5 years ago that every person who refuses nationalism will become a racist, if I told this 5 years ago, perhaps many people would say I'm crazy. But what happened before? What happened in the meantime? We saw that these classes and these groups of people who strongly refused nationalism, now they are the biggest racists in the world. Look at today anti-white racism across the world. Universities have their admission procedure according to race.
Well, yeah,
you need to write race in the paper.
And this is a weird contradiction about the world that we live in now, where you're supposed to think that race doesn't exist, but you're also supposed to hate the white race.
I don't think it is so contradictory, because I'm afraid if these people refuse nationalism, they need to become racist, regardless they want to know.
So why
they want or not?
So why is that? Why do they become racist because they've rejected nationalism?
Because if they refuse nation as community of community of language, history, culture, and solidarity, and even, I think, ground. If you refuse nation, how can you divide between people? Somebody says, I will see all people in the world as the same. But it is very difficult. Show me somebody who can do it. I have never met such a person who can without differentiating between people. It's very difficult.
Yeah. So,
and even it is in, I think it can be seen on European thinking. In 19th century, when modern nations came to being and were framed, at the same time, even races started to be accepted. Before 1800, nobody talked about races. It's a matter of 19th century. And if you see 19th century and philosophers and thinkers of 19th century, you can easily differentiate. Some of them went towards nations, others went towards races. That's very simple.
Right. I think I understand what you're saying. You're saying that there are two different ways to organize the world, and one of them is racial and the other is national.
Yeah, exactly.
So you'd either have the blacks here, whites here, and the yellows here, and the browns here, or you can divide it more precisely down into nations.
Yeah. It was what I wanted to say. And what was the other part of the question?
It was about how people of a certain political inclination would look down on people who belong somewhere. I can't actually remember how it linked with that. I can't remember how we got into this.
Yeah. I think we met another interesting point. And it is that people who belong to a particular nation, and it is important, to a particular country, are different than people that don't belong to particular country. There are big differences even in their mind, in their psyche. You can see it, for example, perhaps it is incorrect, but I will say it, on Jews. Jews who live in Israel, fighting in army, they are very, very brave, very direct, very nationalistic. While Jews who are just scattered internationally without belonging to any country, they are completely other people.
Oh, yes. There's a big divide here. The diaspora Jews are the nomads. They don't belong anywhere, and that's how they survive, by not being
difference in psychology, difference in philosophy, completely different people.
And that explains why they don't move to Israel, because there a lot of people say, well, they've got Israel, why don't they just move there? But it's because they're not adapted for a homeland, for having
a homeland.
It's really quite surprising that they're not psychologically adapted for that, which is weird. So then they've got to continue just wandering, the wandering Jew cliche stereotype. It's a strange, but that brings us back to the international class. Because eventually, they'll be like that, because they'll breed with each other. So then the kids will have those tendencies even more strongly. The genes for being rooted somewhere will be bred out of them, out of that group.
I don't think so. The group is big. For example, if you take in account just upper half of percent of population, or a quarter of percent of population, which means the most rich and the most international, it's more than 6 million people in Western world. So they can organize weddings in this group, and it is quite big. In fact, it is the trouble of our time. If they were small, they were pressed to organize marriages with normal people, but they don't need anymore. They are too big.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess this is to do with the growth of capital, well, corporations, the growth of global entities like that requires ever greater numbers of people to staff those organizations. So that will be thousands of organizations all over the world. So there are going to be much larger numbers of these people than I think a lot of people would realize. They'd assume it'll be about a few hundred thousand of these around the world, but no, it's going to be far more than that now.
If we use Charles Murray estimation of little less than 0.5% as the most rich and most important, and 3% of entire upper class, you have 6 million and 30 million. That's quite big masses. And what is new in our time? They can communicate every day. They have their jets. They have electronic channels. They have no need to communicate to normal people in their countries.
Yeah. And this is part of technology as well, of course. Technology has enabled this way of living where you can chat with people as you and I are doing right now, even with video. Chatting with people across the world. Millennial, indeed, paradoxically, is absolutely dependent on modern technology, emerges from this, and yet harks back to other things. That's quite a contradiction. But anyway, that's part of our modern world. And I think that, again, it's encouraged because... Or it certainly was encouraged up until a couple of years ago to have friends all over the world, to have relationships all over the world, you know, throughout your 20s. I think it was just part of modern life. And for now, for ordinary people, I think it probably won't be such a common thing to do anymore post-COVID with, you know, less international travel. But for that class, it will remain very much the way it
is. Yeah, yeah.
Ironically.
In fact, some 5-10 years ago, perhaps somebody could hope that lower classes will become international as well one day. But now we have, COVID. And I think it is quite possible that in future we have... other epidemies, or perhaps real epidemies. And countries need to be able to close. Because if you are not able to close, any new virus which will appear in 2 years can kill you.
Yeah.
That's one thing.
Yeah.
And another thing is this new Green Deal, which means that normal class people can't fly, they shouldn't drive cars. So chance for international meetings are lower and lower.
Yeah.
And there is one point more, and it is competition. A world I grew up in was quite local, quite national-based world, which meant if you are quite good in one thing, you are the best in your country or good in your country, you had nice life. Now you need to be the best in the world, which is much more difficult, and which means that people who are quite good or even very good are losing competition and they are set aside.
Yeah, this new world, if we do go back to the nation, so to speak, then there will be more opportunities for people who are very good at something. They're just not the best in the world at it. I hope this is true. One of my treasured memories from early childhood, and I don't have many memories from early childhood, but one of them is a local farm. There was a farm nearby where we lived, and they had a shop. And I'm sure that the food from that farm, it was grown on the farm. It was vegetables, onions, potatoes. I can't remember now. But I remember the atmosphere inside this shop was very, you know, it wasn't bright lights. It wasn't sterile. It was extremely cozy and rustic, oldie worldy. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if the food from some, Italian delicatessen or some high-class department store, I wouldn't be surprised if you could get better food than you could get at this farm. But I don't remember any of those delicatessens that I've been to. I still do remember this farm because it was so... It was cozy and it was local. It was tied to that place. It was absolutely tied to that place. The food was grown there in the surrounding fields and then sold to us. And that just seems like something precious. So even if the food isn't brilliant, it has more significance, more meaning than the food that is brilliant. And so this is why there are different ways to measure things, and sometimes the best isn't actually the best in another way.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think food is one of examples. We in Czech Republic see it especially strongly. For example, such simple thing as potatoes. For 300 years, we were very good in growing potatoes. And now, supermarkets buy potatoes from Egypt.
I mean,
our farmers can't sell their potatoes.
Yeah, it even sounds crazy. You know, I would never associate potatoes with Egypt. It just sounds unlikely. And yet this kind of thing happens. You hear about these insane things where it's cheaper for a corporation to have stuff shipped over from India than to just make it here. I mean, that's amazing, really.
We are moving to sociopathy, which we talked at the beginning.
And that was supposed to be our topic.
if you are a corporate manager and you need to enhance profits, you need really at all costs, you can't afford sympathies with local people if it is more profitable to bring, potatoes from Egypt or work from India. You can't afford simple empathy. Yeah. You need to behave as total sociopath.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you will be replaced.
Yes. So whatever is economically most efficient, regardless of what damage it does. But, you know, you and I could say, well, that person lacks empathy. But as you've said, he's also doing it to protect himself, because if he doesn't do this, if he doesn't take these ruthless decisions, then he will be fired. He will lose his job. So, you know, in a way, you know, this is how a system ends up shaping the people inside it and making them go against their instincts. It will actually create sociopaths, in a sense.
I think it is a big difference between now and old capitalism. Because, I don't know, 100 years ago or 60 years ago, of course, people also needed profits. But at the same time, they were dependent on their factories, on their workers, on their colleagues. They understood that they need to behave or doing such things that it works all together, even with these workers. Now then they can replace workers very easily.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they can replace entire workforces very easily now.
Yeah,
Which again is, I think that even 20 years ago, that would have, well, 30 years ago, that would have seemed incredible. Where I think now it's probably, and again, this will be something that gets more and more the case. I can imagine factories that just work on software. So you just have to send the software over from a factory in India to a factory in Sweden, and that factory in Sweden will now do exactly what the factory in India was doing. It's just this set of processes. I mean, it is quite incredible how advanced these systems must be at this point.
Yeah, and it is connected to this upper class, new aristocracia, management class, or how can you call it? Because if you are a real owner of the company, you can say, okay, this profit is okay for me. I don't need higher profit for this year. I prefer a pleasant working environment. I prefer working with nice people, etc.
Yes.
If there are shareholders, you can't do this. You need each quarter to have higher profits. I work for a corporation, so I know it quite well.
Yeah, well, this is the thing about infinite growth, like unending growth, economic expansion. It can only happen at the expense of other priorities.
Yeah.
So this is how you get the, in America, the cliche of the Rust Belt is all these industries that die, the factories that just were abandoned, and I mean, it's happened elsewhere as well. I'm just thinking of that in my head just now. And of course, it has devastating consequences for those local communities. They're just dead. In Britain, we've got all these towns where they used to be mill towns or they used to be mining towns. And they're just dead now. They're full of people on welfare and on drugs.
Yeah, and corporate profits are going up and up and up and up.
Exactly.
Which is completely stupid. Because nothing is produced, no useful is done, and the profits are going up. In the 80s, American sociologist called Peter L. Berger wrote about class conflict between people who are doing real things and people who deal with some symbols. And now we can... Now we can see it, because some people can produce PowerPoints or can do some very strange transactions on exchanges, where nothing real work is done. And other people are doing real cars, real iron, producing real potatoes. And we have two completely detached parts of people.
Yeah.
In fact, it is quite close to our division we discussed. Upper class, aristocracia, and normal people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't like calling them an aristocracy because I like the idea of aristocracy.
Uh-huh.
I don't want them to be that. I mean, because, and the other thing is I don't think they are, in the sense that I think the aristocracy of old, whatever flaws they had, and I'm sure they did have flaws, they at least had education. They knew about the history. They knew about culture. They knew about the arts. I think that the people we are talking about now, the international set, I think they only know about their own culture. I think they only know about their own everything else. As soon as you disrespect or dismiss the connection between culture and a place, I think you're no longer really taking anything seriously. I think you've got a very lightweight view of things.
Perhaps we can differentiate two kinds of aristocracy. First of them is typically for middle age. Warriors, knights, very brave people, very hard. And the second, for example, France in years before the French Revolution. Which yeah. means full of intrigues in a royal court, just power games, full of corruption. That's kind of aristocracy.
More feminine, actually.
Yeah, definitely. More feminine. Yeah, no barriers. Yeah, no fighting.
It's about being sneaky, calculating, socially intelligent, but not really having principles or being steady.
What we can show it, I think, quite nicely. Good illustration. Many centuries ago, people who are members of this aristocracy perform sword fighting as show of or as demonstration of their membership to the class.
Yeah.
In the last 2 years, if young people want to demonstrate their membership to the class, they go and kiss shoes of some black gangster.
That is a very depressing development. The contrast, of course, the Pope did the same thing though with the refugees. I think
he's typical member of this high class.
It is awful. To get back to the issue of sociopathy, because then we'll wrap up. We'll finish because I want to end on that topic. What would you say about? I think most people will encounter a sociopath at some point in their lives, at least once. Would you have any advice for what to do when you conclude that someone you know is a sociopath? Do you have any advice for dealing with these people?
I think there is no very good advice. I have read many books about that. I talked to many people, psychologists who work with them, and I think the only good advice is avoid them at any cost. And there is a second advice which is connected to the first one. Avoid environments which attract such people. If you decide to be a corporate manager, okay, you need to work with many sociopaths. If you decide to be politician, of course, you will meet many of them. It's up to you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, if you do go into that environment, then it's up to you. And, maybe you will be okay at handling them, or maybe they will eat you alive. It's difficult to know
perhaps
in advance.
Perhaps you like it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, let's end it there. So, Petr Hampl, am I pronouncing that correctly?
So, thank you. I liked it.
Okay, good. I'm glad. Thank you for appearing on Millennial. I'll be back in about half an hour with Academic Agent. But in the meantime, Petr, thank you for appearing.
So, thank you. Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.